Today's story that we hear from the Gospel according to Mark is one of those famous beach scenes of Jesus. It's the scene where he begins to gather his very first disciples at the beginning of his public ministry. Now, in John's version of the calling of the first disciples, it's quite different, in fact. But along with Matthew and Luke, Mark places this scene following Jesus' sojourn and temptations in the wilderness. And Matthew and Mark also note that it is followed by the arrest of John the Baptizer. And that's not really meant just as an aside, but it's a significant detail because somehow, at least for Matthew and Mark, it's important that we know John's arrest and disappearance from the scene opens a door, maybe even the final straw that propels Jesus into ministry. So at the start of his wandering ministry, Jesus is walking along the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, we have no idea, we're given no information about what Jesus notices about these folks who are fishing at the sea. But among the many fishers, he takes special notice of two pair of brothers, Simon, whom we later hear called Peter, so Simon Peter, and his brother Andrew are casting their nets into the sea. And then, in turn, he notices John and his brother James, who are mending their fishing nets. And according to Mark, Jesus speaks directly and concisely to them. There's no elaboration, no discussion, no description. Follow me. I will make you fish for people. Follow me. I will make you fish for people. And if we're to believe Mark's story, they drop their nets and they follow, apparently without any question, any hesitation. And the point is even reinforced by adding, in both cases, they did so, quote, immediately dropped their nets and followed. Immediately. Now, we have no idea that if they followed out of curiosity. We have no idea where they were in their lives. Were they bored? Were they ready for a change? Were they suffering from ancient Near Eastern wanderlust? And they wanted to see the rest of the world, and this guy offered some kind of promise of that. We have no idea if they felt spiritually prepared to enter onto a journey, certainly the journey they were about to undertake. But they followed. They dropped everything and followed immediately. The stories of Jesus calling the first disciples, this and the other stories, are among those traditional readings during the season of Epiphany. And not just because it's early on in the stories of Jesus. Recall, Epiphany means appearance or manifestation, this aha moment of divine revelation. And these weeks, I'm highlighting the connection of Epiphany to this other concept of theophany, which means the appearance of a God, a perceptible manifestation in our physical realm of an ineffable, invisible God. And how, because of the long-standing Christian claim that God was incarnate in Jesus Christ, that is in fact a claim of theophany in Jesus Christ, that God was made seeable, hearable, touchable, followable in a sustained and decisive way. Last week, you may recall, it was the story of Moses at the bush that was burning and not consumed, who simply turned aside to look at this curious thing and met God and was called to be the agent of God's deliverance, to liberate the Hebrews from oppression and slavery. That simple turning aside, changing his path and changing the world. This week's story, the call of the first disciples, is a traditional epiphany and theophany because somehow in hearing this simple and direct invitation, maybe a command, who knows the tone, they recognized something of God that they could not resist. Moses at the burning bush, turn aside. Jesus calling along the Sea of Galilee, follow me. Epiphanies and theophanies change the world because they change the trajectory of our lives. Epiphanies and theophanies change the world because they change the trajectory of our lives. Now, in this brief story about Simon, Andrew, James, and John, we might admire their courage. We might even envy their ability to respond so decisively, or it may just seem strange and impulsive to us. But we should recall that to the first audience that heard this or observed this, it would have shocked, even offended them for a couple of reasons. Now, we should probably remember, I'm tripping over my own tongue today. We should probably remember that the primary audience and the largest following of Jesus among those was among those who in our day we might most want to avoid. The last and the least, the unwashed, the broken, the broke, and those who didn't know where their next meal was coming from. Now, in some ways, those peasants in early Palestine had very little to lose and everything to gain by following Jesus. But there's an interesting detail in this story that offers us something a little bit different. The first disciples he calls, certainly James and John specifically, these impulsive followers, were actually successful by at least local standards. Their family business was prosperous enough to have hired helpers. Just those two little words at the end of it, along with the hired help. They were not necessarily wealthy, but they were prosperous enough to be merchants hiring others. They weren't naive youths. They weren't, at least those two, the poorest of the poor. They were probably established business folk. And when they dropped their nets, what they left behind was no small thing. And furthermore, in a society, a traditional society, when they broke with family and occupation, it's extraordinary, it's a disruption, it's an offense, even a scandal, because if they were central to the success of their family fishing business, their sudden departure may even have jeopardized the very welfare of their families. They had more than just a little bit to lose when they followed Jesus, when they dropped what they're doing to follow. They dropped more than nets. They would have been abandoning core responsibilities and their very identities. This was an abrupt and a total redirection of life. It threatened everything that they knew. They had a lot at stake and a lot at risk by following Jesus. Imagine it's as if someone you have never met walks past your office cubicle, your desk, or knocks on your door at home and says, "Hey, follow me." And you drop everything and go. No phone call home, no text to loved ones, no 2 weeks' notice, no severance or vacation pay. No, nothing. That's a little frightening and maybe a little bit creepy. It would look, and it did look, irresponsible and crazy. Moses was redirected by seeing something. This time, they're redirected by hearing something. So irresponsible and crazy, I think this is a story about hearing voices. Now, we all hear voices. Now, some of us hear voices that are managed by medications, and that is only partially a joke, because for some it is a serious need. But even those of us who do not fall into that category, we all have inner voices and outer voices that beg for our attention. So this is a story about which voice are you going to pay attention to? Which voice will define your life? Can you imagine the other voices that Simon and Andrew and James and John must have heard? James and John, do you not think their father Zebedee yelled after them? Shouted after them as they dropped their nets and wandered off. What are the voices that call out to you? It might be inner voices. It might be the voice of that parent or grandparent. It might be the voice of friends or former partners. There may be messages and fears. There can be outer voices, family and work voices, lovers and children, career, the voices that we see on TV and in the movies. Now, they are not all bad, but it is a flood of voices inside and outside. I wonder, in that cacophony, is there space enough to hear one single voice break through? Are we ready and willing for our lives to be so interrupted by a voice that asks that in the middle of everything that we are responsible for and to whom we are responsible, hey, follow me? It will be unexpected, it will be inconvenient, and we will probably feel unprepared. So, are we going to hold on to our nets, our careers, our jobs? Oh, by the way, there's a whole other sermon that I heard when Gail read that, so there you go. It's Mending Our Nets sermon. There you go. Do we hold on to our nets? Do we redouble our effort to mend them and make them stronger, our careers, our jobs, our success, our security, our egos, even some of our relationships? Hold on so tightly to those nets that they, in fact, have entrapped us. Now, we later learn that the ties that these first followers severed were not completely severed with family and community. We learn later that Simon Peter was married and his home was often a location for the Jesus community in Galilee. But it would seem that we are promised that dropping our nets will be disruptive, but not necessarily tragic at the end. But if and when we hear that voice and actually decide to follow, as those who first did said yes, it will, without doubt, redirect our life. I just finished reading a great book, a really wonderful book, written by Diana Butler Bass. It is, I think, her most recent book. And Diana Butler Bass is one of our currently most prominent and well-respected authors writing about the history and modern situation of Christianity and the future of the church, particularly in North America, but globally. And I just finished reading her book, Christianity After Religion. Really wonderful book. There are like half a dozen sermon series out of it, so stay tuned. You're going to hear her name more often. And one of the things that she points out is Christianity has long got the order wrong about the priorities of what it does mean to become a Christian or be a Christian. And she points out in particular, particularly salient to this story, she says, in this call of the first disciples, Jesus didn't ask them anything about what they believed. There was no theological litmus test. Certainly not that you believed in the five fundamentals, some of whom in this room can recite at a drop of a hat. There was no litmus test of belief, but instead it was an invitation to follow. It formed a community first with a simple request for relationship: follow me. It began with an invitation to a relationship first, and anything and everything happened later. I have long tried to find an accurate and concise way to describe my own religious identity. And as a pastor, that's helpful, because people always ask and always inquire. But what's unhelpful is people make lots and lots of assumptions about what it is I might believe and how it is I might live my life because I am a pastor. And for me, the label spiritual but not religious doesn't fit because I am quite religious. I find enormous depth and value in religion. Otherwise, I actually wouldn't be doing this, would I? And I also don't take my religion very seriously because I can laugh at the ridiculous and the extreme in my own Christian tradition. I can weep at the tragedies it has wrought in our world. But I also know I will never abandon the name Christian because I do not want Christianity and its name to be used to abuse and hurt and exclude others any longer. So I will never relinquish that name as well. So I don't easily fit into the prescribed categories or certainly the prescribed assumptions about what it means to be a Christian and a pastor. Sometimes I've tried on the label Christo-pagan, progressive Christian, which seems kind of So here's my new, but I also, you know, I love to, I'm glad you enjoy that. And I also, hopefully you can tell, I love reading about other religious traditions and find great depth and value in their wisdom, no lesser than the value and depth in Christianity, and I remain a Christian. So here's my, I'm trying on this description when people ask me, what is my religious identity? So I consider myself a student of the wisdom of many traditions and remain a committed follower of Jesus Christ. Because I can hold both. You know, I will not relinquish the name Christian, and neither will I discount the wisdom of other traditions. So I consider myself, at least right now, in this moment, a student of the wisdom of many traditions and a committed follower of Jesus Christ. Now, that does do one thing. It helps me avoid having to check off a list of certain theological beliefs, which I think many people have made that decision when they no longer identify themselves with a particular religious name. So to say I'm a follower of Jesus Christ avoids some uncomfortable theological issues, but pause for a moment to say I'm a follower of Jesus Christ plunges you into a whole world of other issues. And I actually think a whole world of harder issues than trying to work your way through some theological issues. Because if I indeed say I'm a follower of this Jesus of Nazareth, what does that path look like? That's harder than wrestling with some theological issues, to say I will follow. It says I will go from wedding feast to washing the feet of others. I will be at dinner parties with the powerful, and I will have supper with the disreputable. I can teach riveted listeners, and I can stand in silence while others falsely accuse me. It will go from cheering crowds to jeering soldiers, from baptism as a beloved child to betrayal by a kiss, to the cross, to the grave, and to resurrection. That's what the path looks like. As I have said before, there is nowhere that we might go that God in Christ has not first gone. So I will follow. What I love about this poem by Rilke that we heard this morning I love Rilke, kind of everything. But this particular poem, not only the admonition that the voice of God encourages us to experience everything, let everything happen, but it ends with these words, "Give me your hand. Give me your hand." We follow, but we do not walk alone. We follow because we are led by the hand, by one that we trust. In the end, better said, at the beginning, we are asked one thing only: follow me. Everything comes after.